Sounds like the starting sign. Good. We stopped somewhere. Mr. and Mrs. Leopold Bloom have left Kingstown for England. That is what the fashionable newspapers would say about the Blooms if they had a higher social standing. Good. Then we read on, say, the next two paragraphs. Yeah.
What course of action did he outline for himself in such capacity? A course that lay between undue clemency and excessive rigour, the dispensation in a heterogeneous society of arbitrary classes, incessantly rearranged in terms of greater and lesser social inequality, of unbiased, homogeneous, indisputable justice, tempered with mitigants of the widest possible latitude, but exactable to the uttermost farthing, with confiscation of estate, real and personal, to the crown. Loyal to the highest constituted power in the land, actuated by an innate love of rectitude, his aims would be the strict maintenance of public order, the repression of many abuses, though not of all simultaneously, every measure of reform or retrenchment being a preliminary solution to be contained by fluxion in the final solution. The upholding of the letter of the law, common, statute, and law merchant, against all traversers in coven and trespassers acting in contravention of bylaws and regulations, all resuscitators by trespass and petty larceny of kindlings, of venville rights obsolete by desuetude, all orator and instigators of international persecution, all perpetuators of international animosities, all menial molesters of domestic conviviality, all recalcitrant violators of domestic conviviality. Prove that he had loved rectitude from his earliest youth. To Master Percy Apjohn at high school in 1880, he had divulged his disbelief in the tenets of the Irish Protestant Church, to which his father, Rudolf Virag, later Rudolf Bloom, had been converted from the Israelitic faith and communion in 1865 by the Society for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews, subsequently abjured by him in favor of Roman Catholicism at the epoch of and with a view to his matrimony in 1888. To Daniel McGrane and Francis Wade in 1882, during a juvenile friendship, terminated by the premature emigration of the former. He had advocated during nocturnal perambulations the political theory of colonial, e.g. Canadian, expansion, and the evolutionary theories of Charles Darwin, expounded in The Descent of Man and The Origin of Species. In 1885, he had publicly expressed his adherence to the collective and national economic program advocated by James Fenton Lawler, John Fisher Murray, John Mitchell, J.F.X. O'Brien, and others, the agrarian policy of Michael Davitt, the constitutional agitation of Charles Stewart Parnell, MP for Cork City, the programme of peace, retrenchment and reform of William Ewart Gladstone, MP for Midlothian, NB, and in support of his political convictions, had climbed up into a secure position amid the ramifications of a tree on Northumberland Road to see the entrance, 2nd of February 1888, into the capital of a demonstrative torch-like procession of 20,000. Divided into 120 trade corporations, bearing 2,000 torches and escort of the Marquis of Ripon and John Morley. How much and how did he propose to pay for this country residence? As per prospectus of the Industrious Foreign Acclimatized Nationalized Friendly State-Aided Building Society, incorporated 1874, a maximum of £60 per annum, being one-sixth of the assured income derived from gilt-edged securities, representing at 5% simple interest on capital of 1,200, estimate of price at 20 years purchase, of which a third to be paid on acquisition, and the balance in the form of annual rent, viz. £800, plus 2.5% interest on the same, repayable quarterly in equal annual instalments until extinction by amortization of loan advanced for purchase within a period of 20 years, amounting to an annual rental of £64, head rent included, the title deeds to remain in possession of the lender or lenders, with a saving clause envisaging forced sale, foreclosure, and mutual compensation in the event of protracted failure to pay the terms assigned. Otherwise, the messuage to become the absolute property of the tenant occupier upon expiry of the period of years stipulated.
I don't know how you are, but I couldn't understand anything. It's just a voice going on. Is it better for you? So, I can just guess that we are here at the top, but the quality has never been so bad for me. and I don't know what I can do here. Anyway, Bloom, as a JP, as a justice of the peace, what course of action did he outline for himself in such capacity? And of course, the middle way, a course that lay between undue clemency, softness, and excessive rigor. The dispensation of heterogeneous society, a society that's heterogeneous, that doesn't try to keep itself pure. So it has foreigners and immigrants and all of that. And of course, Bloom would have this view. Of arbitrary classes, incessantly rearranged in terms of greater and lesser social inequality, unbiased, homogeneous, indisputable justice. However, his judgment should be homogeneous. And you can see this chapter balances similar words again. Heterogeneous, homogeneous. Justice must be open. Tempered with mitigants of the wildest possible latitude, but exactable to the uttermost farthing. So again, it has to be both soft and rigorous. With confiscation, and that would be a severe punishment, of estate, real and personal, to the crown. Loyal to the highest constitutional power in the land, actuated by an innate love of rectitude. His aims would be the strict maintenance of public order, the repression of many abuses, though not of all simultaneously, every measure of reform or retrenchment being a preliminary solution to be contained by fluxion in the final solution. Reform and retrenchment were political slogans at the time. Upholder to the letter of the law, that's literally common statute and laws merchant. These are the various parts of law, common statute and merchant law. Against all traverses in common, common is a collusive agreement, conspiracy. In common, and trespassers acting in contravention of bylaws and regulations. All resuscitators, those who call trouble, by trespass and petty larceny of kindling. Larceny is a theft. And of course, the law distinguishes various kinds of theft. Of venial rights has to be tenure, and obviously land possession. Obsolete by desuetude. Desuetude is when something is no longer used, when it's out of habit. All orotund, that is those who can't speak loudly, orotund, instigators of international persecution. And you know, he became here close to Bloom's attitudes before. All perpetuators of international animosities. All menial molesters of domestic conviviality, all recalcitrant violators of domestic conviviality. So there should be laws against, and the law should be executed against it. Though he himself, as we know, tolerates that in the case of his wife. Then it says, proof that he had left rectitude. That is the right views and all. It's a law that the Romans had to believe in rectitude from his earliest youth. To Master Percy Absolute at high school in 1880, he had divulged his disbelief in the tenets of the Irish Protestant Church, to which his father Virag, later Rudolf Bloom, had been converted from the Israelitic faith. And we know that Bloom's father had converted to Protestantism for commercial reasons in 1836 by the Society for Promoting Christianity Among the Jews. So there was such an institution that helped Jews to convert and become Protestants. Subsequently, abjured by him, certainly had moved away from it in favor of Roman Catholicism at the epoch of and with a view to his matrimony in 1882. And in other words, since the Catholic Church doesn't easily tolerate mixed marriages, so the partner that would be Bloom, marrying Molly, Tweedy, he would have to convert to Catholicism. And it's quite obvious that he must have gone through a very, very superficial crash course because he doesn't know anything. And for him, it doesn't matter. But it's interesting that Bloom has, in a way, a stake in Jewish, Protestant, and Catholicism, and yet is outside of it. He has three confessions and none. To Daniel McGrane and Francis Wade, we don't know them, obviously. In 1882, that is the year when Stephen and Joyce were born, during a juvenile friendship, terminated by the premature emigration of the former, and that is, of course, something that happened that quite a lot. Families and men, they emigrated to find a better life, usually in America. He had advocated during nocturnal perambulations, and that's again one of these words, when you walk around at night, the political theory of colonial, that is Canadian expansion. So there must have been something like the British Empire. And the evolutionary theories of Charles Darwin, so he had been a follower of evolution, expounded in The Descent of Man and The Origin of Species. These are Darwin's essential books. In 1885, he had publicly expressed his adherence to the collective and national economic program advocated by James Fenton Leyler, and that was a politician at the time. And at the end of the 19th century, these were the issues that were discussed, and Bloom had taken a certain interest in. John Fisher married John Mitchell. He was exported to Australia. J.F.X. O'Brien. When somebody is called FX, it's always Francis Xavier. It's always in honor of the Jesuit priest. So you would know that at least the parents were good Catholics and others. The agrarian policy of Michael Davitt. Michael Davitt did something for the Irish peasants, the Land League, that was very much in the air. The constitutional agitation of Charles Stuart Parnell, Member of Parliament for Cork City. And Parnell was, of course, the politician who brought the Irish close to, but not to, home rule, which they wanted, a kind of autonomy that never came about until much later. The programme of peace, retrenchment, reform of William Edward Gladstone. Gladstone was the big a liberal prime minister who was in a way helpful for the Irish side, but he never quite came off. An important figure in England, MP for Midlothian, NB. Norton. And in support of his political convictions, and that's more interesting, he had climbed up into a secure position amid the ramifications of a tree on the Northumberland Road to see the entrance, 2nd of February, 1880. To, by coincidence or not coincidence, the birthday of Joyce, the birthday, not date, of Joyce and Stephen, into the capital of a demonstrative torchlight procession by 20,000 torchbearers divided into 12 trade corporations, bearing 2,000 torches in the escort of the Ripon and honest John Morley. So these were people helping the Irish cause, but it never quite came up. And so that just, in a way, rehearses Irish politics, you might say, in the last 20 years. How much and how did he propose to pay for his counter-residence? Remember, the ideal home, the house, would have cost quite a bit. And of course, it's far beyond Bloom's means. As per prospectus, of the industrious, foreign, acclimatized, national, friendly, state-aided building society, incorporated in 2004, a maximum, so these were the ideas, a maximum of £60 per annum. So that would be the rent, being one-sixth of an assured income derived from gilt-edged securities, that would be bonds, they usually had a gilt edge, representing as 5% simple interest of a capital of £12,000. A lot of money, of course. Estimate of price of 20 years purchase. Of which, one-third to be paid on acquisition and the balance in form of annual rent, that is to say, 800 plus 2.5% interest on the same. Repayable quarterly in equal annual installments until extinction by amortization of loan advance for purposes within a period of 20 years. That's, of course, the language of contracts and laws where this would be. Amounting to an annual rental of £64, head rent included. I don't know what head rent is. The title deeds to remain in possession of the lender or lenders with a saving clause envisaging forced sale, foreclosure, mutual compensation in the event of productive failure to pay the terms assigned. So, legal terminology, contracts. Otherwise, the message to become the absolute property of the tenant occupier upon expiry of the period of year stipulated. Well, it will take a contemporary lawyer to explain it. That's all what we got. No.
Equine handicap, flat or steeplechase, of one or more miles and furlongs, won by an outsider at odds of 50-1, at 3:08 p.m. at Ascot, Greenwich time, the message being received and available for betting purposes in Dublin at 2:59 p.m. Dunsink time. The unexpected discovery of an object of great monetary value, precious stone, valuable adhesive, or impressed postage stamps, 7 shilling mauve, imperforate, Hamburg, 1866, 4 pence rose blue paper, perforate, Great Britain, 1855. 1 franc stone official, rouletted diagonal surcharge, Luxembourg, 1878. Antique dynastical ring, unique relic in unusual repositories or by unusual means. From the air, dropped by an eagle in flight, by fire, amid the carbonized remains of an incendiated edifice, in the sea, amid flotsam, jetsam, lagan, and derelict, on earth, in the gizzard of a comestible fowl. A Spanish prisoner's donation of a distant treasure of valuables or specie or bullion, lodged with a solvent banking corporation 100 years previously at 5% compound interest of the collective worth of £5 million sterling. A contract with an inconsiderate contractee for the delivery of 32 consignments of some given commodity in consideration of cash payment on delivery at the initial rate of a farthing, to be increased constantly in the geometrical progression of 2, a farthing, a halfpenny, a penny, tuppence, fourpence, eightpence, 1 and 4pence, 2 and 8pence, to 32 terms. A prepared scheme based on a study of the laws of probability to break the Bank of Monte Carlo. A solution of the secular problem of the quadrature of the circle, government premium, £1 million sterling. Was vast wealth acquirable through industrial channels? The reclamation of dunams of waste arenary soil, proposed in the prospectus of Agendath and the Time, Bleibtreustrasse, Berlin W15, by the cultivation of orange plantations and melon fields and reafforestation. The utilization of waste paper, fells of sewer rodents, human excrement, possessing chemical properties in view of the vast production of the first, vast numbers of the second, and immense quantity of the third, every normal human being of average vitality and appetite, producing annually cancelling byproducts of water, a sum total of £80, mixed animal and vegetable diet, to be multiplied by 4,386,035, the total population of Ireland, according to the census returns of 1901. Were there schemes of wider scope? A scheme to be formulated and submitted for approval to the Harbour Commissioners for the exploitation of white coal, hydraulic power, obtained by hydroelectric plant at peak of tide at Dublin Bar, or at head of water at Pool of Fuca, or Powerscourt, or catchment basins of main streams for the economic production of 500,000 WHP of electricity. A scheme to enclose the peninsular delta of the North Bull at Dollymount, and erect on the space of the foreland, used for golf links and rifle ranges, an asphalted esplanade with casinos, booths, shooting galleries, hotels, boarding houses, reading rooms, establishments for mixed bathing. A scheme for the use of dog vans and goat vans for the delivery of early morning milk. A scheme for the development of Irish tourist traffic in and around Dublin by means of petrol-propelled riverboats plying in the fluvial fairway between Island Bridge and Ringsend. Charabancs, narrow-gauge local railways, and pleasure steamers for coastwise navigation, 10 shillings per person per day, guide, trilingual included. A scheme for the repristination of passenger and goods traffics over Irish waterways when freed from weed beds. A scheme to connect by tramline the cattle market, North Secular Road and Prussia Street, with the quays, Shera Street Lower and East Wall, parallel with the Link Line Railway, laid in conjunction with the Great Southern and Western Railway Line. Between the Cattle Park, Liffey Junction, and terminus of Midland Great Western Railway, 43 to 45 North Wall, in proximity to the terminal stations or Dublin branches of Great Central Railway, Midland Railway of England, City of Dublin Steam Packet Company, Lancashire Yorkshire Railway Company, Dublin and Glasgow Steam Packet Company, Glasgow, Dublin and Londonderry Steam Packet Company, Laird Line, British and Irish Steam Packet Company, Dublin and Morecambe Steamers, London and North Western Railway Company, Dublin Port and Docks Board Landing Sheds and Transit Sheds of Palgrave Murphy and Company, steamship owners, agents for steamers from Mediterranean, Spain, Portugal, France, Belgium and Holland, and for animal transports and of additional mileage operated by the Dublin United Tramways Company Limited to be covered by graziers' fees.
Good. Yeah, what rapid but insecure means of to opulence might facilitate immediate purchase. Now, where would the money come from? A private wireless telegraph, which would transmit by dot and dash system, the Morse code, the result of the national equine handicap, flat or steeplechase, of 1 or more miles and furlongs, won by an outsider at the odds of 50-1 at 3:08 p.m. at Ascot, Greenwich time. The message being received and available for betting firms in Dublin at 2:59 dancing time. Now, I don't quite understand why this wasn't done anyway, because Dublin time, Dunsink Observatory deviated from Greenwich time by some degree, about half an hour. We heard that before. And so if you can telegraph or telephone the result, you would know it in a way in Dublin before it's 3 o'clock. I can't imagine that wasn't done all the time, but there it is. Then, the unexpected discovery of an object of great monetary value, precious stone, valuable adhesive on impressed postage stamps. Of course, postage stamps were being collected. And as you all know, or heard about. There are some very early ones that get a lot of money. 7 shillings moved for Hamburg. So these must be old, well-known stamps at the time that would cost a lot of. You don't have to go through them to Luxembourg. And of course, often when they had a misprint, they were even more valuable. Then, 1 franc stone official, antique dynastic ring, unique relic. I think most elder people will think of the Silla ballads where some ring, gold ring, was dropped from an eagle. So it doesn't happen so often, but it's one way. An unusual reposited by unusual means from the air. Yeah, dropped by an eagle in flight by fire. Amid the carbon, as you mentioned, and in the office, you might find something in the burnt ruins. In the sea, amid flotsam, jetsam, lagan, and derelict. These are the things that are washed ashore, and whatever is at the shore belongs to the king. You can't just take it home. And that is called flotsam, jetsam, what's thrown, and lagan, and derelict. These are legal differences for the various things that can and that you cannot just own. On earth, in the gizzard of a commercial fowl, a ring might be inside or something. A Spanish prisoner's donation of a distant treasure of valuables in specie or bullion, that's how gold is, lodged with a solvent banking corporation 100 years previously at 5% interest. If somebody 100 years ago had deposit some at 5% interest, wouldn't work so well today, but that was always that. The collie worth of 5 million pounds sterling. So, and don't forget, a million would be an immense number on that. Mm-hmm. A contract with an inconsiderate contractee, somebody naive, for the delivery of 32 consignment of some given commodity in consideration of cash payment on delivery per delivery at the initial rate of 1/4 of pence to be increased constantly in the rate of progression of 2. So if you had to double, that's the old story you should have heard of one rice corn on the first field of a chessboard. And of course, it would come to an immense amount that we can't imagine. So 1/4, 1/2, and so on, to 35 terms. These are the things that will be published in newspapers. Then, a prepared scheme based on a study of the laws of probability to break the Bank of Monte Carlo. That is one way of getting rich. And there was, in fact, a song, which is also enjoyed, The Man That Broke the Bank in Monte Carlo. That was very much in the air. A solution of the secular problem of the quadrature of the circle. As you know, one of the geometrical problems is the quadrature of the circle, the quadrature des circles, that you can change a sphere, a circle, into a square, which doesn't seem to be possible mathematically. Government premium, 1 million pounds sterling. That was merely a rumor. The British state never offered that, but it would be one way of making money. Was a vast wealth acquirable through industrial channels? It could be different. You could really have a good investment or a good plan. The reclamation of dunams of waste arenary soil. Dunam is an oriental measure. And in Bloom's first outing to the butcher, he picked up that prospectus of Agendath Netaim, the planter's company, that you can invest in buying a plot of ground in Palestine. Obviously, you wouldn't get very rich, but that's coming up. Proposed in the prospectus of Agendath Netaim. That existed, the planter's company, which was settled or situated in Bleibtreustrasse, Berlin W15. And that's where it was. And oddly enough, as people checked, this particular building survived the Second World War, the bombing and all of that. I've seen it. By the cultivation of orange plantations and melon fields and reafforestation. And that's more modern. The utilization of waste paper, felled of sewer rodents, rats, human excrement possessing chemical properties in view of the vast production of the first waste paper, the vast number of the second, lots of rats, and the immense quality of the third. You could, of course, use, and of course it was used then. And I think he's also thinking of things like guano, you know, when the excrement of birds is valuable. Every normal human being of average vitality and appetite producing annually, cancelling byproducts of water, a sum total of 80 pounds mixed animal and vegetable diet to be multiplied by 4,000 and so on, the total population of Ireland according to the census of the 1901. So we know at least roughly how many inhabitants Ireland did have, around 4 million. Were there schemes of wider scope? A scheme to be formulated and submitted for approval to the Harbour Commissioners for the exploitation of white coal, that is hydraulic power that we have in Switzerland, and of course there are not many mountains in Ireland, obtained by hydroelectric plant at peak of tide or Dublin Bar or at the head of water pool of Fouca or Powerscourt. That's where the Liffey comes down. They might exploit water power. A basin of main streams for the economic of 500,000 white water horsepower of electricity. Obviously, electricity was then measured as by water horsepower. A scheme to enclose the peninsula delta of the North Pool at Dollymount, that is in the southeast of Dublin, and it was at that time a swampy kind of area that could have been utilized. A scheme to enclose and erect on the space of the foreland used for golf links, rifle ranges, and as far as parade, with casinos, booths, shouting galleries, hotels, boarding houses, reading rooms established for mixed bathing. So, in the meantime, of course, that land has been reclaimed. A scheme for the use of dog vans and goat vans. You don't need horses. Dogs could draw a little van or goats for delivery of early morning milk. Including that thing, the milkman came in the morning. A scheme for the development of Irish tourist traffic in and around Dublin. That was yet only beginning. Between Island Bridge and Ring's End, that would be the river up to Island Bridge, that the river as it flows through Dublin. Charabancs, now against local railways and pleasure steamers for coastwise navigation. 10 shillings per person per day. Guides, trilingual included. I wonder what the three languages were. Clearly, English and French. I wonder what the third one was, German perhaps? A scheme for the repristination and fastened on goods traffic over Irish waterways. The 18th century was when where canals were dug. In West, there are two canals in Ireland, the Royal Canal and the Great Canal that we've already seen, but they, of course, were no longer quite usable for ships and all of that. That, of course, could have been revived when freed from wheat beds. A scheme to connect that tram line, Cattle Market, North Circle and Prussia Street with the quays, South Street Lower and East Wall. So that is what Bloom has said, because the cattle was driven along North Circle Road in a kind of semicircle from the Cattle Market to the embarkation point, and Bloom thought there could be railways or trams or something like that, with the Link Line railway late. And then it says, in connection with the Great Southern Westward and the whole rest of the paragraph, there are all the various private railway company and steamship companies that were in a way competing. So there wasn't one particular state or city transport system, but there were many of them, and I don't think we have to read them out in great detail. They are existing. Good. That's how far we got.
Positing what protases would the contraction for such several schemes become a natural and necessary apodosis? Given the guarantee equal to the sum sought, the support by deed of gift and transfer vouchers during donor's lifetime, or by bequest after donor's painless extinction of eminent financiers, Bloom Pasha, Rothschild, Guggenheim, Hirsch, Montefiore, Morgan, Rockefeller. Possessing fortunes in six figures, amassed during a successful life, and joining capital with opportunity, the thing required was done. What eventually would render him independent of such wealth? The independent discovery of a gold seam of inexhaustible ore. For what reason did he meditate on schemes so difficult of realization? It was one of his axioms that similar meditations, or the automatic relation to himself of a narrative concerning himself, or tranquil recollection of the past, when practiced habitually before retiring for the night, alleviated fatigue and produced as a result sound repose and renovated vitality. His justifications? As a physicist, he had learned that of the 70 years of complete human life, at least 2/7, viz. 20 years, passed in sleep. As a philosopher, he knew that at the termination of any allotted life, only an infinitesimal part of any person's desires has been realized. As a physiologist, he believed in the artificial application of malignant agencies, chiefly operative during somnolence. What did he fear? The committal of homicide or suicide during sleep by an aberration of the light of reason, the incommensurable categorical intelligence situated in the cerebral convolutions. What were habitually his final meditations? Of some one sole unique advertisement to cause passers to stop and wonder, a poster novelty with all extraneous accretions excluded, reduced to its simplest and most efficient terms, not exceeding the span of casual vision and congruous with the velocity of modern life.
Yeah. Then it's interesting here, the terminology. We have positing what protases would the contraction for such several schemes become a natural and necessary apodosis. My guess is that most of us don't understand that. It has a protosis and an apodosis. And it took a student from Ticino to say that these are grammatical categories that I don't think we heard, Greek word, of the part of a conditional sentence. A protosis is, and if since were that, then the apodosis is things would be like that. So if I won in the lottery, I might buy something. You know that if sentences cannot be falsified. It's hard. It's also, by the way, the perennial excuse of something. You can excuse anything by saying, if things had been different, they wouldn't have been like that. So that's how could our things become real under what circumstances? If then, given a guarantee equal to the sum thought, the support by deed, gift, and transformation during the donor's lifetime, you might be given something, or by bequest after donor's painless extinction, the eminent financiers, Bloom, Pasher, that was a famous one, Rothschild, of course, Guggenheim, Hirsch, Montefiore, Morgan Bank, Rockefeller, these were the rich people of the day. Possessing fortunes in six figures. Now, that six is not even a million, you know. You can see how things have lost their value. Amassing a successful life and joining capital with opportunity, the thing required was done. You might get something from these rich people. I'm sure you get them every day. There isn't a single day when seven rich people don't say they will give me a few millions. I wouldn't even know where to put them. I think you know what I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. What eventuality would render him independent of such wealth? The independent discovery of a gold seam of inexhaustible ore. You know, if you find a gold fish. Obviously, that is a reminiscence of the gold rush. And gold isn't usually discovered in big quantities. For what reason did he meditate on schemes so difficult of realization? Why think about that? It was one of his axioms. And you know, an axiom is something that you start from that you don't have to prove. That similar meditations to all the automatic relation to himself of a narrative concerning himself or tranquil recollection of the past when practiced habitually before retiring for the night, alleviated fatigue and produced as a result sound repose and the remove vitality. So it doesn't help, but if you do that thing, you may sleep better before falling asleep. His justifications. As a physicist, he had learned that of the 70 years of complete human life, at least one seventh, that is 20 years, are passed in sleep. Now, why 70 years? I don't quite know what the average age was, but the Bible says you live 70 years, and if you're lucky, it's 77. So that's part religious, and it may have been statistic. As a philosopher, he knew that at the terminated of any allotted life, only an infinitesimal part of any person's desires had been realized. Yeah, you understand that. As a physiologist, he believed in the artificial placation of malignant agents, chiefly operative tumors. It seems to be good against bad ideas that you might have in bed. And they're listed in the next thing. What could happen to you in sleep if you're not responsible for yourself? The committal of homicide or suicide during sleep. By an aberration of the light of reason. Okay. The incommensurable, that is immeasurable, categorical intelligence situated in the cerebral convolution. We have quite a lot of potential in the cerebral convolution, and Bloom often thinks of the brain as against the soul in religion. what were habitually his final meditations? Of some one sole unique advertisement or advertisement to cause passers to stop in wonder. Well, of course, the ideal advertisement that would have a great impact. And you realize that's a kind of relatively modern idea. In fact, I must have said several times that the personnel of Ulysses is quite up to date. Stephen is a teacher and wants to be a writer, not successful. Bloom is in advertisement, in a way that is the profession of the future, 100 years ago already, and Molly is a singer. So these would cover the media at the time. A great advertisement, with all experience excluded, reduced to its simplest and most efficient terms, not exceeding the span of casual vision, and congruous with the relish of modern time. Something is easy to read and has an impact. That is the kind of ideal advertisement. Now we have a long paragraph of something different.
What did the first drawer, unlocked, contain? Avere Foster's handwriting copybook, property of Millicent Bloom, certain pages of which bore diagram drawings marked Papley, which showed a large globular head with five hairs erect, two eyes in profile, the trunk full front with three large buttons, one triangular foot. Two fading photographs of Queen Alexandra of England and of Maud Branscombe, actress and professional beauty. A Yuletide card, bearing on it a pictorial representation of a parasitic plant, the legend Mizpah. The date, Xmas 1892, the name of the senders from Mr. and Mrs. N. Comerford, the versicle, "May this Yuletide bring to thee joy and peace and welcome glee." A butt of red, partly liquefied sealing wax, obtained from the stores department of Messrs. Healy's Limited, 89, 90 and 91 Dame Street. A box containing the remainder of a gross of gilt J. pen nibs, obtained from same department of same firm. An old sandglass which rolled, containing sand which rolled. A sealed prophecy, never unsealed, written by Leopold Bloom in 1886, concerning the consequences of the passing into law of William Ewart Gladstone's Home Rule Bill of 1886, never passed into law. A bazaar ticket, number 2004, of St. Kevin's Charity Fair, price sixpence, 100 prizes. An infantile epistle, dated small m, Monday, reading capital P, Papley, comma, capital H, how are you? Note of interrogation, capital I am very well, full stop. New paragraph, signature with flourishes, capital M, Millie, no stop. A cameo brooch, property of Ellen Bloom, born Higgins, deceased. Three typewritten letters, addressee Henry Flower, care of P.O. Westland Row, addresser Martha Clifford, care of P.O. Dolphin's Barn. The transliterated name and address of the addresser of the three letters in reserved alphabetic boost troppodontic punctuated quadrilinear cryptogram. Vowel suppressed. N-I-G-S stroke W-1-U-U O-X stroke W O-K-S M-H stroke Y-I-M. A press cutting from an English weekly periodical, Modern Society. Subject, corporal chastisement in girls' schools. A pink ribbon, which had festooned an Easter egg in the year 1899. Two partly uncoiled rubber preservatives with reserve pockets, purchased by post from Box 32, P.O. Charing Cross, London, W.C. One pack of one dozen cream-laid envelopes and faint-ruled notepaper, watermarked, now reduced by three. Some assorted Austrian-Hungarian coins. Two coupons of the Royal and Privileged Hungarian Lottery. A low-power magnifying glass. Two erotic photo cards showing A, buccal coition between nude senorita, rear presentation, superior position, and nude torero, fore presentation, inferior position. B, anal violation by male religious, fully clothed, eyes abject, or female religious, partly clothed, eyes direct. Purchased by post from Box 32, P.O., Charing Cross, London, W.C. A press cutting of recipe for renovation of old tan boots. A one-penny adhesive stamp, lavender, of the reign of Queen Victoria. A chart of measurements of Leopold Bloom, compiled before, during, and after 2 months of consecutive use of Sandow Whiteley's pulley exerciser, men's 15 shillings, athletes 20 shillings, viz. Chest 28 inches and 29 and a half inches, biceps 9 inches and 10 inches, forearm 8 and a half inches and 9 inches, thigh 10 inches and 12 inches, calf 11 inches and 12 inches. One prospectus of the Wonder Worker, the world's greatest remedy for rectal complaints, direct from Wonder Worker, Coventry House, South Place, London, EC, addressed to Mrs. L. Bloom, with brief accompanying note commencing, Dear Madam.
Let's go on, dear.
Quote the textual terms in which the prospectus claimed advantages for this thaumaturgic remedy. It heals and soothes while you sleep. In case of trouble and breaking wind, assists nature in the most formidable way, ensuring instant relief in discharge of gases. Keeping parts clean and free, natural action. An initial outlay of 7 and 6 pence, making a new man of you and life worth living. Ladies find Wonder Worker especially useful, a pleasant surprise when they note delightful result like a cool drink of fresh spring water on a sultry summer's day. Recommended to your lady and gentleman friends, lasts a lifetime. Insert long round end. Wonder Worker. Weather testimonials. Numerous, from clergyman, British naval officer, well-known author, city man, hospital nurse, lady, mother of five, absent-minded beggar. How did absent-minded beggar's concluding testimonial conclude? What a pity the government did not supply our men with Wonder Workers during the South African campaign. What a relief it would have been.
So here we have a drawer unlocked contains all the kind of junk. This is quite interesting because it shows the kind of what people lived and all how it was at the time. All the junk. A Weir Foster's handwriting copybook, property of Millicent Bloom. There were, you know, when you in the old time, you had to write onto lines and into squares and all of that. And the Weir Foster, that was stationery for school children. Certain pages which bore diagram drawings marked, you see, this is a drawing that Millie did of her father, which showed a large globular head with five hairs erect, two eyes in profile, the trunk full front with three large buttons, one triangular foot. So you could actually draw this. Two fading photographs of Queen Alexandra of England and of Maud Branscombe, actress and person of beauty. We already heard of Maud Branscombe. She must have been a famous beauty. And we have some pictures of her. Then a Yuletide card bearing on it the pictorial representation of a parasitic plant. What is that? The legend Misbah, which I think means East, and the date Christmas 1892, name of the senders, from Mr. and Mrs. Comerford, the versicle, may the Yuletide bring to thee joy and peace and welcome thee. A butt of red, partly liquefied sealing wax, because some letters were sealed with wax, obtained from the store department of Messrs. Ely Limited, 1889-19 Dame Street. That is the firm that Bloom worked for, and it still existed in the 60s of last century. When I saw them. A box containing the rainbow, the remainder of a gross. I think a gross is 12 times 12. Or some of J. Penips. You know, you had steel pens that you could put into a holder or something, and these were sold. Because they still wrote with pen and ink. Obtained from the same department of same firm. an old sand glass which rolled, containing sand which rolled. A sealed prophecy, never unsealed, written by Leopold Bloom in 1886, concerning the consequences of the passing into law of William Ewart Gladstone's Home Rule Bill, and Gladstone, the English liberal, was in cooperation with the Irish Party to get Home Rule through Parliament, and they never did at the time. Never passed into law. A bizarre ticket number 2004 of St. Karen's Charity Fair, price sixpence, 100 prizes, so obviously did that. An infantile epistle, dated small, and here you have a letter from Millie, and it's described. This one, small M, Monday, reading, capital P, Poppy, common, comma, capital H. How are you? Note of interrogation. Capital I am very well. Full stop. New paragraph. Signature flourish. Capital M, Millie, no stop. So the letter is described. That's the way you would dictate it too. A cameo brooch. Property of Ellen Bloom, born Higgins, deceased. So that would have been Bloom's mother. And as I said already, we don't know much. If your name is Higgins, it's a very English or Irish name, you're unlikely to be Jewish, and that is passed on through the mother. A cameo scarf pin, property of Rudolph Bloom, born Lirac, deceased. Three typewritten letters, addressee, Henry Flower, COP of Western Row. Remember the letter he picked up in the fifth chapter? Addressor, Martha Clifford, COP of Dolphin's Pond. That is the letter he picked up. The transliterated name and address of the addressor of the three letters in reversed alphabetic boustrophedonic. I don't know if you're familiar. In writing, in old writing, don't forget, we write from left to right, or from right to left. But of course, the most economic way of writing would be when you come at the end of the line on the right, you would continue right to left. And that is called boustrophedonic, the way oxen turn. You know, in plowing you do this. And this is a kind of thing to write. It is a kind of secret code. A punctate quadrilinear cryptogram. So there were four letters on a line. Vowels suppressed without the vowels, and of course, vowels suppressed you get in Semitic languages. And there it then says what it is, and it's not quite clear. It says the correct address and. Of it. Not quite correct. I have to look it up. It says Martha Clifford's first name. Martha Clifford. And so that's one simple way of disguising handwriting. A press cutting from an English weekly periodic Modern Society, subject corporal chastisement in girls' schools. Probably that was of some interest to Bloom, how girls are chastised, probably slapped on the bottom or something like that. A pink ribbon which had festooned an Easter egg in the year 1899. Two partly uncoiled rubber preservatives with reserve pockets. So he has some condoms. no idea. It says it right here. It wouldn't have been easy to get that in Dublin. with reserve pockets, purchased by post from Box 32, P.O., Charing Cross, London. Now, Charing Cross in London must have been famous for kind of shady things that you could buy. In my time, it was famous for books and second-hand bookshops. I think it still is, W.C. A pack of 1,000 cremated envelopes and a faint-ruled notepaper, watermarked, now reduced by 3. So these are that he had used for the previous correspondence. Some assorted Austrian-Hungarian coins, obviously his father brought. 2 coupons of the Royal and Privileged Hungarian Lottery. We have heard from time to time that Blum must have tried to make some money by selling tickets of the Royal Privileged Hungarian Lottery, which did exist. We have documents in the foundation. I don't quite know how you would have sold them. And of course, these would have been illegal because lotteries were illegal. A low-power magnifying glass. 2 erotic postcards showing a buccal, by mouth, coition between new senorita, rear presentation, superior position, and new torero, for presentation, inferior position. It's for you to depict it. B, anal violation by male religious, fully closed, eyes abject, or female religious, partly closed, eyes direct. So that would be the church clergy part of pornography. Purchased by post from Box 30, P.O. Charing Cross, London, W.C., same place. A press cutting of recipe for renovation of old tan boots. A 1 pence adhesive stamp, lavender, of the reign of Queen Victoria. A chart of the measurements of Leopold Blum, compiled before, during, after 2 months, consecutive use of standard Whiteley's pulley exercises, men 15, athlete 20, that is, chest 28 inches and 29.5 inches, biceps 9 inches and 10 inches, forearm 8.5 inches, in the unsold height, and there you have this. Now, to me, that doesn't mean anything, but people have figured it out and found that Blum, who is rather a little stocky, is a little bit, that his chessmen are very small because it seems that Joyce took it out of that book that we have. Again, from time to time, and it shows Joyce's interest in that kind of thing. There was a bodybuilder, the first, by the name of Eugene Sandow. He was a German, and he did circus acts, how strong he was, and he published a book in which he shows that you do push-ups and things like that, and you can become a man like him. It's a very interesting book because he shows himself sort of semi-naked in a Greek, as a Greek hero and all of that. So that was very popular at the time. But it seems that people found that the measurements first in it is of somebody who was quite small, and Joyce didn't know it. On the other hand, Joyce could play with Blum's chest measurements. By the way, I think most of us do not know, or have long forgotten, what our chest measurements were. I have no idea. And Joyce picked a small one. and then the last one is quite extensive, and that's why I had to read the whole thing. One perspective of the Wonder Worker. There has been a reference of the end of Cyclops when Blum walked in the street, and remember, he released himself by a backward noise. And he said briefly, that wonder worker which I had, and we don't know what it is. You know, a wonder worker is something that works wonders. And if you want to become a saint, you have to have three wonders to your credit. Otherwise, it doesn't work. But here, wonder work is something different. And here it comes. And I think it's quite amusing. The world's greatest remedy for rectal complaints. Rectal complaint. You know where the rectum is. Complaints. It's such a nice description. Complaints direct from mother worker coming to her Southbridge, London, you see, addressed erroneously to Mrs. Elbloom with brief accompanying note commencing erroneously, dear madam. He ordered that and they sent it to his wife. Then quote the textual terms in which the prospectus claimed advantages for that thaumaturgic remedy. Thaumaturgic is, of course, ecclesiastical. And you find it on churches and things like that. It means wonder worker in Greek. Now, this is what the prospectus says. It heals and soothes while you sleep in case of trouble in breaking wind. Assists. I mean, even the form of breaking wind is quite interesting. You have to appreciate that. Assists nature in the most formidable way, ensuring instant relief, discharge of gases, keeping parts clean and free natural action. An initial outlay of 7 and 6, making a new man out of you and life worth living. Ladies find wonder work especially useful. Pleasant surprise when they note delightful results like a cool drink of fresh water, spring water on a sultry summer's day. Recommend it to your lady and gentleman friend. Lasts a lifetime. Insert long round ends. Wonder worker. So there's that. Well, there are testimonials, numerous. From clergymen, British naval officers, well-known author, city man, hospital nurse, lady, mother of 5, absent-minded beggar. Now, you probably haven't, not called it absent-minded beggar. It came up earlier in the library scene. Kipling, during the Boer War, since there was no insurance for soldiers, he raised money for all kinds of accidents and things like that, for a charity. And he wrote The Absent-Minded Beggar. For some reason, and don't ask me why, Absent-Minded Beggar was a Kipling. So that meant an English soldier in the Boer War. Absent-Minded Beggar. Don't know. How did absent-minded beggar concluding testimony concluded? So that is a soldier in South Africa. What a pity the government didn't supply our men with wonder workers during the South African campaign. What the relief it would have been. So he says, now I think there's an additional twist here for the Boer War. Where at first the South Africans, the Dutch, the Boers, they were first victorious and occupied a few cities. But then the British came and there were famous battles and they were called the Relief of Ladysmith and the Relief of something or other. So there's an additional little touch there that has gone unnoticed. Good. Then you go on.
What object did Bloom add to this collection of objects? A fourth typewritten letter received by Henry Flower, lit HFBLB, from Martha Clifford, find MC. What pleasant reflection accompanied this action? The reflection that, apart from the letter in question, his magnetic face, form, and address had been favorably received during the course of the preceding day by a wife, Mrs. Josephine Breen, born Josie Powell, a nurse, Miss Callan, Christian name unknown, a maid, Gertrude, Gertie, family name unknown. What possibility suggested itself? The possibility of exercising virile power of fascination in the most immediate future after an expensive repast in a private apartment in the company of an elegant courtesan of corporal beauty, moderately mercenary, variously instructed, a lady by origin.
Now we go on.
What did the second drawer contain? Documents. The birth certificate of Leopold Paula Bloom. An endowment assurance policy of £500 in the Scottish Widows Assurance Society, interstated Millicent Millie Bloom, coming into force at 25 years, as with profit policy of £430, £462, 10 shillings, and £500 at 60 years or death. 65 years or death and death respectively, or with profit policy paid up of £299, 10 shillings, together with cash payment of £133, 10 shillings at option. A bank passbook issued by the Ulster Bank College Green branch, showing statement of account for half year, ending the 31st of December 1903, balance in depositor's favour, £18, 14 and sixpence sterling net personalty. Certificate of possession of £900 Canadian, 4% inscribed government stock, free of stamp duty. Dockets of the Catholic Cemetery's Glasnevin Committee, relative to a grave plot purchased. A local press cutting concerning change of name by deed poll.
What object did Bloom add to its collection of objects? A fourth typewritten letter received by Henry Flower, let Henry Flower be Leopold Bloom, from Martha Clifford, find MC. So the letter he picked up from Martha Clifford. What pleasant reflection accompanied this action. After all, that was a kind of flirtatious letter. The reflection that, apart from the letter in question, his magnetic face, form and address had been favourably received during the course of the preceding day by a wife, Mrs. Josephine Breen, born Joseph Powell. Remember in the eighth chapter he talked to her, and they were formerly a little bit friendly, but in the meantime, she has grown older. A nurse, Miss Callan, Christian name unknown, that is the nurse in the hospital. A maid, Gertie, familiar name unknown. He has seen Gertie McDowell, but he doesn't know her name, only Gertie, because they called her. What possibility suggested itself? The possibility of exercising virile power of fascination. In the not immediate future, and that's a kind of ideal setup, after an expensive repast in the private of the company of an elegant courtesan of corporal beauty, moderately mercenary. So she should be very beautiful, but not cost too much. The variously instructed lady by origin, that's a kind of wish. But then the second drawer, and the second drawer has serious documents, the kind of things you would keep. Documents. The birth certificate, and you need that, of Leopold Paula Bloom. And here for the first time we know that Bloom has a middle name, but middle names were used, and the female name, Paula, which means actually little. And as you may well know, quite a number of names put in a second female, Rainer Maria Rilke, and so on. So that was quite common. And it's, of course, expressive of the female element in Bloom that we heard. An endowment assurance policy. 500, the Scottish Widows Assurance Society. This, I think, is still going strong. The Scottish Widows Assurance Society intestated Millicent Millie Bloom. So there's some kind of insurance for Millie. Come into force of 25 years. That's another 10 years off. With a profit policy of £430. 462, 10 and 500 at 6 years of death. So there's something. 6 years or death and death respectively. Or with profit policy paid up of £200, 10 shillings, together with cash payment of 135 and so on, and our option. So these are, that's obviously money, insurance money, for him. A bank passbook issued by the Ulster Bank College in Brown showing a statement of an account for half year ending 30th of December. Balance in the depositor's favour, £18.14.6. So there's a little bit of money in the bank. £18.14.6 stolen. Net personalia. Certificate of possession of 900 Canadian 4% inscribed government stock, free of stamp duty, dockets. Yeah, so there's that. It looks like a lot of money, but I've been told by those who have looked into it that that Canadian investment wasn't a sure one. It was a bit chancy. And dockets of the Catholic Cemetery's Closing Committee relative to the grave plot purchased. You had to purchase a grave plot. You had to buy your own grave. Although cutting concerning change of name by deed poll. And you see from here that against expectations, Bloom is better off than many of us thought. Just how well off, it's not easy to say, but it is just as Odysseus, when he came home, he had lots of money. He was quite well off. And then it has a press cutting concerning change of name by deed poll. When you change your name in England, it takes deed poll. I don't think it was very easy in Switzerland. Maybe it's better now. Never done it. Yeah, and then we go on.
To the textual terms of this notice. I, Rudolf Virag, now resident at number 52 Clanbrassil Street, Dublin, formerly of Jean Bathily in the Kingdom of Hungary, hereby give notice that I have assumed and intend henceforth upon all occasions and at all times to be known by the name of Rudolf Bloom. What other objects relative to Rudolf Bloom, born Virag, were in the second drawer? An indistinct daguerreotype of Rudolf Virag and his father Leopold Virag, executed in the year 1852 in the portrait atelier of their respectively first and second cousin, Stefan Virag of Szeszfővár, Hungary. An ancient Haggadah book in which a pair of horn-rimmed convex spectacles inserted marked the passage of thanksgiving in the ritual prayers for Pesach, Passover. A photocard of the Queen's Hotel Ennis, proprietor Rudolf Bloom. An envelope addressed to my dear son, Leopold. What fractions of phrases did the lecture of those five whole words evoke? Tomorrow will be a week that I received. It is no use, Leopold, to be with your dear mother. There is not more to stand to her. All for me is out. Be kind to Athos, Leopold, my dear son, always of me. Das Herz, Gott, dein.
That's good to stop.
What reminisce?
Yeah, that indeed Paul says, and that's a change of name. Rudolf, I realize now resident number to the Clanbrassil Street, Dublin. We know where Bloom was born and grew up, Dublin. It was in the old Jewish quarter of Szombathely in the Kingdom of Hungary. Hereby give notice that I have assumed and intend henceforth upon all occasions and all times to be known by the name of Rudolf Bloom. So Virag, flower, is changed to Bloom. And that, of course, is an official document. What other object relative to Rudolf Bloom, born Virag, were in the second drawer? An indistinct daguerreotype of Rudolf Virag and his father Leopold Virag. You see the names Rudolf and Leopold. These are Austrian names, of course. Leopold is an old daguerreotype, and we know he was the first professional photographer. And the plates are usually on glass. In the portrait of their respective first and second, Stefan Virag of Szeszfővár. That is a city in Hungary. Fehérvár means white cross in Hungary. So it's interesting, you see, Bloom's ancestor was an early photographer, and Millie Bloom is apprenticed in a photography shop. So there's a kind of line there. An ancient Haggadah book, that is the Easter service that we had in chapter 7, the Bloom remembers, in which a pair of horn-rimmed convex spectacles inserted marked the passage of Thanksgiving in the ritual prayers for Pesach. That we have heard long ago. Passover. A photograph of the Queen's Hotel, Ennis, proprietor Rudolf Bloom, in an envelope of flowers to my son Rudolf. And you have an envelope addressed to his father, who killed himself, left a letter to his son. What fractions of phrases did the lecture of those fathers evoke? So he thinks of that. So this is what his father wrote. And you know that in Hungary, of course, the language with the world was German. And Bloom has a German book in his things, and he thought his son might have learned German. So there is often a German streak. And in Hungary, that was the language to know. Tomorrow will be a week that I received. It is no use, Leopold, to be with your dear mother. So maybe he got news of the death of his wife. That is not more to stand to her. All for me is out. Be kind to Athos, the dog, Leopold. My dear son, always of me, and then does Herz got dying. So it seems at old age he would drift to an earlier language, German, or Hungarian, and you can see at the end it is German. But you will also notice, and I think only we can notice that probably, when he says, that is not more to stand, not no more, not more to stand, this is German, das ist nicht mehr auszuhalten. So it's, and all for me is out, is almost more German than English. So we see by steps, he goes back to a German kind of English, to a real German. Yeah. And that is a good place, I think. No, we can just still do a little bit more. We do two more paragraphs. Yeah.
What reminiscences of a human subject suffering from progressive melancholia did these objects evoke in Bloom? An old man widower, unkempt hair, in bed, with head covered, sighing. And infirm dog, Athos. Aconite resorted to by increasing doses of brains and scruples as a palliative of recrudescent neuralgia. The face and death of a septuagenarian, suicide by poison. Why did Bloom experience a sentiment of remorse? Because in immature impatience, he had treated with disrespect certain beliefs and practices.
Yeah. What images of a human subject suffering from aggressive melancholia did his object work in Bloom? So his father, when he suffered, he had pain. An old man, widower, in unkempt of hair, in bed, with head covered, as a Jew, sighing, an infirm dog, Athos. Aconite. Aconite was a medication, but if you took too much, it was a poison. And he died of an overdose of aconite. Resorted by increasing doses of grains and scruples as a palliative for pain of incrudescent neuralgia. So he had obviously headaches that got worse. Facing death of a septuagenarian, 70 years old, suicide by poison. Grains and scruples. Scruples are little measures for pharmacists. Pharmacists don't measure in grams, but in scruples. A scruple is a little stone. So scruple here is a measurement and not a psychological state. or it might come in. Why did Broome experience a sentiment of remorse? Because in immature impatience, he had treated with disrespect certain beliefs and practices, because he had little respect for Broome's father, who obviously still held on to his Jewish beliefs. And Broome regrets that he didn't treat that with the necessary respect. I think we stop here in the middle of quite an important passage. Good, then. Now, next time is, wait a moment, is Ascension. Now, I think we don't hold our thing because we Silke is home and has a holiday and deserves a holiday. So we meet after Ascension. And of course, I wish you a good ascension straight into heaven. Yeah. I'd come back down in time. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.